Case number 215482, United States of America versus Zachary Fuchs. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Germany, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Ned Germany, may it please the court, I'm representing Zachary Fuchs this morning. Your Honors, as you know from the, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Your Honors, this case involved a traffic stop on Highway 70 in Galloway, Tennessee. My client, Mr. Fuchs, was driving. He was pulled over by an officer of neighbors who allegedly observed a vehicle without a tag. He started questioning Mr. Fuchs on the side of the road. At some point in time, he claimed in court that he smelled marijuana and therefore had an interest in searching the vehicle. He ended up actually getting in the vehicle at some point. He moved it because it was blocking traffic. It was pulled into a parking lot, but I think there was a truck that was trying to get by. So he got in the car, he moved it. Now, when he did get in the car and he moved it, he decided that he would roll up the windows. And he stated in court the reason he did this was because he wanted to make sure to preserve any kind of evidence in case, when he was going to run his dog. I guess he wanted to make sure that the smell in the car was contained.
Can I ask you a question just about the standard of review? Because I do think that you have very powerful evidence in this case. It's not every day that you get a police officer's boss to come in and testify against the police officer. Right. But what I'm having trouble with is our standard of review. So those arguments would have been very good in front of the district court, who examines the credibility of the witnesses. But now we're under this very deferential clear air standard of review. And I'm curious whether you, I didn't see any in your brief, but I would give you the opportunity to identify cases where courts have reversed under the clear air on this type of credibility finding. It seems like it's a very difficult standard. I'm wondering if this would be the first one.
It's certainly very difficult. I would agree with the court. I don't have any cases for your honors, but certainly not only did we have the police chief, the now police chief, the formerly, he was a captain at the time, state all of what he said regarding the camera, regarding the, he didn't smell marijuana, regarding the fact that he would run the dog and no matter what, he was going to predict exactly what would happen in real time. I mean, those are all very troublesome. I presented that argument to Judge Norris as well as, I believe, Judge Vescovo initially. And of course, Judge Norris had more information than just Judge Vescovo. But, I don't believe that it's a situation where the Sixth Circuit won't just look at the district court and say, you know what? There might not be a case yet, but there's always a chance to get that one case to show, hey, it is possible. If there's ever a case where you're going to reverse these deferential findings, it would be this case.
Mr. Germany, it's Judge Kohler. I guess just in response, it seems to me, as Judge Murphy has said, you've got to point to us, evidence, compelling evidence that would persuade the court to find that there's clear error as to these credibility findings. But here, as I understand it, when officer neighbors pull the vehicle over for not having a license plate, there's also corroborating evidence from the camera that there is no license plate, no indication that the officer removed the license plate. By the time Chief Mays got there, the windows had been open for a little bit and maybe the smell of marijuana had dissipated. The car was moved at the instruction of Mays because it was blocking a driveway because a truck wanted to get out. So I just am wondering if this is that case where despite some of the more negative things that appear to exist as to neighbors' conduct in the past, that there's just doesn't seem to be that one case where we're just so compelled to find that these credibility determinations are not supportable.
I understand, Judge Cole, and I appreciate your comments, but I respectfully disagree. I just have to believe that this would be the case that would, you know, represent that, hey, you know, sometimes district courts, their findings are just simply not supported by the fact. And I think that when you have the chief coming in saying he should have never been a police officer, I wouldn't trust him. I've seen him steal records. I mean, the list went on and on. It's just briefed, I think, very well. And I think it was hashed out during the testimony very well. I'm hoping that this is the case, but I understand that it is a high, high burden.
What about the inevitable discovery doctrine? How do you get around that?
Well, I understand that the court, he made a finding that, you know, under the facts of this case that, and I understand even Mays said it himself, that we would have found those drugs. But when you look at where these drugs were in a hidden compartment, I mean, what is the purpose of a inventory search? It is to look around the vehicle and inventory objects just in case it protects the police department. We don't want to get sued. We don't want to be accused of anything. We're going to look around. We're going to take inventory. We're going to note everything in the car. It doesn't mean it's a full-fledged search, you know, looking in hidden compartments and things of that nature. So I disagree with the court's ruling that it would have been inevitably discovered.
Do you think, is that a fact question that we would review deferentially? Or do you view it as a legal question that we would review?
Well, it may be mixed, but I think that is I think it's mixed probably, but the big part of it is, I think it's deferential.
I thought some of the case law suggested they needed to have kind of a discrete policy, not just with respect to when you tow a vehicle, but with respect to the protocols that you undertake for the inventory search. I didn't necessarily see that in your brief, but I was curious if you would opine on that, because nobody talked about the policies to like how they go about the actual search during the inventory process.
Right, and I asked, I'd gone out to the Galloway Police Department and I asked Mays that, and of course it came out at the hearing, you know, what are the policies? And I think what he stated was, well, we're working on that. We haven't done it yet. The former chief, Jewel, would not, you know, go along with that, but we're trying to get that in order. And I think that brings up another issue. When you're just working on it, you just refuse to have a policy. I mean, is there any policy at all, or is it just unfettered discretion to do whatever they want?
Well, I mean, Mr. Germany, can I just clarify on this? So I understood those questions and your briefing here to be focused on the first part of the inevitable discovery, which is, would the vehicle have been towed? Because sometimes there's discretion to allow the officers to call a third party to come pick it up. So that's step one. And I understood your argument to be focused on that, and that's what you preserved and argued here. And both officers testified, well, yes, we do have some discretion. Sometimes we can call a third party, but here we don't know who that third party is, because we don't even know if this car was stolen. We still don't know who it belongs to. So we don't have any discretion in that kind of case, or we never would have exercised it.
Right.
The second piece that you're talking about now is, once it's impounded, would these drugs have been found in this location in the car? And that piece, I'm not sure you really argued. So can you speak to that?
About the first part, about whether or not it would have ever been towed or...
Well, I'm more interested in the second part. Did you preserve your claim that I heard you make now, that the officers wouldn't have looked in this what you're calling a hidden compartment. I don't know. It kind of looked like a, to me like a tray, some kind of a coin tray.
Right. I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And in fact, I have a vehicle that has a similar pullout. So, but I think that I'd have to review the transcript to answer that question properly. But you know, again, and I see that I'm out of time.
You may come back.
Okay. I'd have to review the transcript to see if I properly properly preserved that, Your Honor. So,
okay.
Thank you. My time is up. So
you'll have your full 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Hort, we'd like to hear from you next.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Sean Hort for the United States. The district court correctly denied the defendant's motion to suppress. In addition, the district court properly allowed the 404B evidence of the defendant's previous conviction. And finally, the district court did not abuse its discretion by denying the defendant's motion for mistrial. This court should affirm. First, I'd like to bring the court's attention to the issue of the 404B evidence that was provided at trial of Mr. Fuchs's prior federal conviction for manufacturing methamphetamine. Here, we were presented with the case, and I think Mr. Germany addressed some of the facts, but we had a case. The case was Mr. Fuchs was driving a motor vehicle. There was no tags on the vehicle. He was the sole occupant of that vehicle. When he was pulled over, he was hostile to the arresting officer. While he didn't have license, insurance, or any registration for the vehicle, and while the officer was calling in the information about Mr. Fuchs, he saw Mr. Fuchs moving about the motor vehicle in the area of the console and underneath his feet. This gave Officer Fuchs concern to the point where, and he had just received information that Mr. Fuchs could potentially be armed with a firearm from dispatch. He pulls Mr. Fuchs out of the vehicle and while questioning Mr. Fuchs, Mr. Fuchs admits that.
Can I stop you there? He claimed to have smelled marijuana. I have to say that that's incredibly fishy testimony when you review it in light of Chief Mays, when you review it in light of the fact that it wasn't in the affidavit, when you review it in light of the fact that I don't know when the state court hearing was, but he didn't mention this in the state court hearing. I know that standard is deferential, but do you think that there, what facts do you think we would need in order to overturn, say, the smell of marijuana in the car? If these facts aren't enough, do you think it's just essentially unreviewable on appeal, or do you what would be enough to overturn that type of credibility finding?
I believe that there was no evidence to support that allegation of, you know, that the court could potentially make a credibility finding. But here, what we can look at his contemporaneous actions that were recorded on the body cam. He rolled up the window of the vehicle as he testified to. He smelled the odor of marijuana and he rolled up the window to preserve that smell of marijuana. So that's contemporary. He did that at the scene. So the court can
look at the window at the scene, but he didn't say on his body camera, gee, I think I should roll up this window because it smells like marijuana in here and I want to preserve the smell.
And unfortunately, not all officers are trained well to narrate what happens. But he did question.
Why didn't he test to do? Can you talk a little bit about the state court? Why didn't he mention this in this? Because that seems even more contemporaneous to his federal. I don't know the dates of the two. I'll be honest, I didn't look into that. But what's your response to why he didn't mention this at the state court hearing?
I frankly don't know. It's not been briefed.
It's mentioned in the briefing that he didn't mention it.
Well, yes. That. Yeah, you know, he just said he had escaped him at the time because he had relied on the dog sniff to ultimately get into the vehicle.
Well, that was his testimony with respect to why he put it in the affidavit, which is somewhat understandable. But why would he testify to it in the federal, which is much later, the federal hearing and not the state hearing? That's perplexing to me.
And Your Honor, there was
was he asked about it?
I believe he was asked about it in the state court, and he just said he had simply just neglected to say it because he was just relying off his affidavit, which in his affidavit he had said that, you know, based on the dog sniff, that's the reason why he went into the vehicle. But here we also have Mr. Fuchs admitting to that there could be potentially be a joint in the vehicle. So yes, that would also.
I'm interested in that. I was about to ask you about that. So that statement was suppressed. And we know that means it can't be used at trial, right? But the Supreme Court has been pretty clear that that's all that it means, right? Like you can use suppressed statements in front of a grand jury and various other things. Do you have any authority for the proposition that the fact that he admitted to having a joint in the car would allow the magistrate judge or the district judge at a suppression hearing that can be used to sort of bolster the credibility of the witness, right? Because if that statement had not been suppressed, then obviously, like, it makes him much more credible that he smelled marijuana in the car if the guy just admitted, yeah, there's marijuana in the car. But it was suppressed. So what do we make of that?
A suppressed statement can be used for other purposes other than, you know, at trial. It can be used to substantiate probable cause for the search of the vehicle. I don't have authority available to the court at this time, but I do know that suppressed statements still can be used in probable cause findings, in which the court did here is that the court did use this.
I was curious, why did you put that in your appellate brief? Because I thought there's a recent case called, I think it's United States versus Patane, P-A-T-A-N-E, that says un-Mirandized statements, as long as they're voluntary, don't lead to the poisonous tree or whatever for physical evidence recovered by them. But I don't know that you necessarily argued the point, and I was curious why.
Your Honor, we did not argue the point, and I can't say that we were familiar with that opinion to argue that point, Your Honor. So if we neglected that, I would apologize. But as the court's familiar, that statement does give credibility to what the officer's neighbors, that, you know, this was not, you know, a no. There's no chance that there was a marijuana. He says yes, this potentially. So that does substantiate to a degree what officer's neighbors is doing. Then him rolling up the window shortly after that statement is made would also goes to show that yes, there was potentially an odor of marijuana there, and that he rolled up that window to preserve that smell of the marijuana. So when he were to perform that drug sniff, that dog drug sniff, that the dog could potentially, react to that smell, Your Honor. But
what about the inventory search? So we've got step one on the policy, like, would this vehicle have been towed, or was there discretion, meaning that there wasn't a sufficient policy? And then there's step two, even if it had been towed, would you have found these drugs under this inventory search? I asked Mr. Germany if he had argued about step two, or if he had only argued about step one, only contested step one. He wasn't sure. What do you think about that? Both whether it was preserved and whether it would have been found. I guess I'm interested in your answer to both.
Yeah. As preserved, are you regarding the issue or just whether or not the.
Well, it's very clear that Mr. Germany says, you said there would have been this would have been inevitably discovered. He said, no, it wouldn't have been inevitably discovered because there wasn't a sufficient policy in place to establish the fact that the vehicle would have been towed. But then there's step two, would it also have been found? Had, assuming we think, yes, it would have been towed, would you have found these drugs in this car?
Yes.
And, well, you know, they're in this, like, they're under this removable tray. They're not, like, sitting on the seat or something, or in the glove box.
Yes. For the first, to the first part, you know, there was a well-established policy. Yes, it was not written. It should have been written. Yes, it should have been written. But the previous authorities said that, you know, while there doesn't have to be a written policy, there needs to be some sort of scheme that's, you know, that's well-defined within the department regulations. And both the chief and Officer Neighbors basically were able to testify to the four corners of that that policy. You know, that they would, you know, tow the vehicle if the driver didn't have a license, if the vehicle didn't have a registration, or the vehicle didn't have insurance. Now, you know, there was some wiggle room there for officer discretion, especially if they could find, if it was just for no driver's license, then it would have, you know, it could have, you know, released to a person with a license. We didn't have any of that here. We didn't know who the vehicle belonged to. We didn't know Mr. Fuchs didn't have a license, and that's an arrestable offense in the state of Tennessee, and nor did he have insurance. So the car would have been towed no matter what. Now, whether or not it would have been found, this was found with, you know, within seconds of Officer Neighbors entering the vehicle. You know, it was just found under a cubby that had a, you know, quickly, easily removable tray. There was other evidence in the vehicle, such as the bag that was similar in size and makeup that had methamphetamine residue in it. Just the finding of that could have supported the
issue. Do you think that there has to be, that the actual search, once it's at the impound lot, has to be undertaken pursuant to protocols about the scope of the search? I thought there was some case law on that. I guess not argue, but it does seem like you would bear the burden of proof to show inevitable discovery. And I don't think can it be a standard, this search, or does it have to be pursuant to like a search protocol on how you inventory?
Well, it wasn't raised in argument. I mean, both officers believed that it would have been found. I mean, this wasn't, you know, a well-hidden object. It wasn't buried in the floorboard under the seat or underneath a seat that is not easily removable, such as the bench seat. This was simply a cubby that had a plastic insert that you could easily pull out. So, you know, this was not, you know, they didn't go to any extraordinary length of this. You know, again, they didn't remove carpeting. They didn't remove door panels. This was just of the contents of the vehicle. And this was easily foundable within, again, seconds. So this was not, you know, really anything outside what would have been a standard inventory search, at least as testified as these two officers testified to.
Because your recollection is that both officers testified, yes, this is the kind of place that we would have looked in an inventory search.
They both testified that this the methamphetamine would have been found during the search.
Mm-hmm. So we should treat this removable cubby just like, obviously, what you inventory, you look in the glove box.
Effectively, yes. I mean, you know, again, it was not extraordinary in any fashion. I mean, they didn't look any, you know, compartments that were not easily accessible. It was there. So no, it should be just treated as if it was a glove compartment because it was easily accessible.
Switching to the 404B question, we do seem to have some tension in our case law between Bell and Hardy on the connection that's necessary between the conviction. Would you concede that under Bell, this should have been excluded, the prior conviction, and that it really depends on a broad scope of kind of the related to test that is necessary?
I would argue that under Bell, the argument is harder for the government under those circumstances, but not impossible. And we have, you know, we have an individual who's charged with methamphetamine offenses in both cases, you know, in either manufacturing or intending to deliver over 50 grams or more, large amounts of methamphetamine. And here, you know, while, you know, the time is not, you know, from the conviction to the charge and the new offense is, there's some tension there. The point where he had just recently ended service of that federal sentence, and within a year, he commenced this new possession of this large amount of methamphetamine. So I would argue that effectively, yes, you know, the argument is harder, but it is, we could still make the case there.
Mr. Hort, I know your time has expired, but I wonder if you would take just 30 seconds to respond to what is, you know, for me, a lingering concern, and of course, just speaking for myself here. You know, Mr. Germany started his argument saying that this is the case, that one case where, you know, our court should find that there's clear error as to credibility determinations. And I guess I kind of just, without spending time going through the various, the testimony that would cast some doubt on neighbors' credibility, you got a chief of police who's saying this guy would lie about the big and the little things, lie when it was not even no reason to lie. He's a bad apple. You know, he shouldn't be with the department. Fuchs was not making furtive movements in the front of the car. He, in fact, was just talking on the telephone. I understand that the Epic report came back that Fuchs had, you know, been convicted as a felony of manufacturing meth and known to carry a gun, but there's so much, you know, in this record that kind of casts serious doubt. I mean, it's not that often you get testimony from the chief of police who just says, I've got an officer who just, you know, lies so much. I don't want to overstate it, but the May's testimony, but, and even as to using Kilo the dog to search the manner in which Fuchs did that. There's just a lot here that casts a serious cloud in my mind over this officer's credibility. And I understand this deferential standard at this point. You want to take 30 seconds to respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is a question that we did ask Chief Mays about, and I'd like to refer the court to page ID 735 and 736 of the record. Chief was asked, and did Officer Neighbors make the right calls that day? On that particular day, yes, sir. I'm not going to take away from that stop. It was a great stop. The stop initiated for a tag violation, from my understanding. Did you see anything that concerned you during that stop? No, sir, not at the time. No, sir, not at all, because again, I still say it's a good stop. It was a great stop. The tag came back, gave him probable cause to do what, to continue his search, but nothing else to go on that. There was no other paperwork that Mr. Fuchs could provide him, nor do I think he had a driver's license or anything else. And with that, I give it to anybody. That's a great, it was a good stop because he pulled his drugs there and off the streets immediately. Chief Mays credited Officer Neighbors' work on that given day. Yes. They had issues. There were credibility issues between the two of them. But on that day, Chief Mays did credit Neighbors' work. And that's why we're here about today, is what occurred on June 6, 2018. And on that day, Chief Mays said Officer Neighbors did his job correctly.
Okay. Apparently no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Hort.
Thank you.
Mr. Germany, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. Just regarding that great job that he did, the fact that he stated that he had smelled Mays had smelled marijuana before, but he didn't smell it then. and he found that to be dubious. As far and the flight, you know, the turning the camera on, he turned it on late after the stop. Well, why did he do that? Well, he got confused. I asked Mays about that. He's confused. He's an expert at that. There's no way to mess that up. So maybe Mays tried to fix it for the government in the end, but the damage had already been done. I did want to just mention the Arizona v. Hicks argument that I had made before the court, as well as this court. You know, the government stated in their brief, on page 24 of their brief, it is true that neighbors rolled up the window to preserve the marijuana odor, but this does not constitute a search, is what they said. But the reality is, what the law states as far as that Taylor versus City of Saginaw, I mean, it states that, you know, if you move a car in an attempt to find something or obtain information, I mean, it's a violation. He didn't necessarily get into the car with that purpose. I'm not saying that. But once he got in that car, he rolled up that window. Isn't that to preserve the evidence? Isn't that exactly what he stated? So, I mean, the government's own brief says that. So how do you get around that? How was this not preserving the evidence? You know, the Hicks case is a little different. You're turning around stereo equipment, but the principle is the same. The analogy is the same. I mean, if you can't turn around stereo equipment and you're really not, I mean, I don't even know what the policy is as far as moving the vehicle in the first place. Why are you allowed to get in the vehicle in the first place? What's the policy on that? I know the city of Memphis has a policy, and that is an officer shall never get into that car. Under no circumstances will they get in that car. But it seems like Galloway didn't have any policy, so they can do whatever they want. And then once they can do whatever they want to get in that car, you know what they can do? Hey, we're going to roll up the window too, because we want to preserve evidence. We don't want any kind of smells emanating. So it's just, I mean, I think that Hicks, you know, Hicks is a very good case in this instance, I believe. And I just, you know, would encourage your honors to give that a second look. As far as the 404B, your honors.
Because I'm curious to get your reaction to why we shouldn't find the 404B issue, even if there is error, harmless. Because there was quite a bit of evidence against your client, and I'm curious if you would opine on the harmlessness issue.
Well, the evidence against my client is simply that he was driving around the vehicle, and there were drugs found in the vehicle. When you couple that with with the 404B evidence we think that shouldn't be submitted, the fact that he has a prior manufacturing offense 18 years ago. I just don't see how that should have been admitted. And then it's compounded by the agent who inexplicably during the questioning by the prosecutor regarding like, why do you think he's guilty? Well, he's got this prior manufacturing. And then, you know, I objected. And so, stopped her somewhat, but I mean, you still know about the meth. Well, I think what it said was the methamphetamine, but I stopped, you know, it was going to say methamphetamine manufacturing or conviction or whatever, which is exactly why you can't do it. I mean, he did it then, he did it now. So that's what she's saying.
But even if all of that is true, even if we were to agree, I think this was Judge Murphy's question, that the 404B evidence shouldn't have come in and she shouldn't have made that statement. Why isn't it harmless given, assuming that the evidence was properly admitted, you know, he's the sole occupant of the car. We don't know who the car could have belonged to. There's the baggie at his feet by his shoes. And then there's a pound of meth and this behind this little removable compartment. If all of that comes in, that's pretty overwhelming evidence of guilt. And so you'd have to make the case that this did harm, even if it should have come in.
Right. And I think
like the jury would have been substantially swayed by the 404B evidence in light of all this other evidence.
Well, they struggled with the verdict. I will tell you that the jury did struggle with the verdict. And part of the problem was is that it wasn't just about the drugs found at his feet. I think the reason that they struggled was because you had Officer Neighbors involved. And I think once he was involved and the jury heard all that, and they didn't even hear all of it because I was forbidden from asking certain questions, but they heard enough and it made them pause. They didn't come back immediately with the verdict at all. They deliberated. They didn't come back immediately. And I think the reason they did is because Neighbors clouded the whole case for the government. If it wouldn't have the Neighbors involved in this case, I would agree. This case would have been an easy case for the government. But because Neighbors, all of the things that were involved in his testimony, the jury heard enough, and it gave them pause. And so I don't think it's a slam dunk, but I mean, that's the whole point of what Bell was saying is, you know, you have this evidence, overwhelming evidence. Why are you throwing in this prior conviction? I think what they said is you're just piling on. And I think that's what Bell said not to do. So, but I see my time is out. It's a pleasure to be before the court. I know that y'all aren't taking a whole lot of oral arguments, and I do really appreciate, on behalf of Mr. Fuchs, the opportunity to argue before the court. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Germany and Mr. Hoard. We certainly appreciate your arguments this morning, and we thank you for your briefing and as well, and appearing via Zoom. So thank you very much, and the case will be taken under submission.